your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life.
And good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And that was, of course, Buffy St. Marie. My God, I love Buffy. That was a Carry It On from her 2017 release, Medicine Songs. This is the second Wednesday of the month where we generally have my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who I just heard is on the line. She is on a writer's retreat and so is not here live in the studio as she almost always is. But in fact, she is on the line with us by telephone. Good morning, Jackie.
Morning. Morning.
How are you doing?
Good. Good. I'm out, and my cell signal is not what I thought it would be out here. So, but I was trying to get away from it all to get writing done. So
that helps. I know you've had a lot of projects. You've got a book. You're still, I guess, finishing up. I guess the comments from the publisher or the book about the Malheur. And, talk about that book.
Yeah, the book is called Standoff, and it basically compares the two standoffs from 2016, which is the Bundy takeover of Malheur and Standing Rock, which I covered both of them as a journalist. So I look at both of them and. It's coming out during the 2020 elections in August, and it basically, I'm looking at sort of the underlying causes for a lot of the, the political and social conflict in the country right now, and that's sort of the underlying sort of philosophies, philosophical underpinnings of the political conflict we have today going on in the country. I think that everyone is looking at the election to see what it means about America. And I think that these two particular standoffs really are really very instructive to understand the different polar opposites that are in our country right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the subject you wanted to talk about today, what makes someone Native American, is may some people may feel like it, it's a sort of a discussion for Native American people themselves, but obviously you feel it has much broader meaning and importance, and you're as you said with the work you do, you're bringing it to bear on our current social political situation crisis. And I, of course, added to that because I'm part of the conversation, being the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio, what it means to be a settler colonial immigrant like me, and how do those of us who are not indigenous relate to Native people, to the history, to Native struggles, to the idea of indigeneity itself, and of course, we each come from our own positionality. I can only speak from my own personal, family, cultural background. And, of course, the important conversation is how that all intersects and how we together confront this deep history that you're talking about. So with that, why specifically did you want to talk about what makes someone Native American on today's show?
Yeah, because it's as a journalist, it's a topic that comes up over and over again, it's really a topic I never thought I'd have to address, because growing up as someone who looks obviously Native and it just never occurred to me that that there would ever be a question about who was Native. I mean, I said that there were questions to degrees. Yeah, I mean, like, my mom's a full blood who grew up speaking her language. My grandparents are traditional Navajos who didn't even speak English, who lived entirely traditionally. You know, my grandmother wove rugs. My grandfather, you know, took care of the cattle and you know, all their siblings, the whole generation that were just traditional Navajo elders, you know? And that's within my own lifetime. and then there's, you know, my father who was, his reservation was far more overrun by white people. They were basically a minority on their own land because of the, because their land was allotted out into parcels. And then everything that was left over, you know, was homesteaded by given to white farmers. And so, you know, that was a much more of a direct assault on their culture and their identity. And so I understood there were degrees of being Indian, right? But I didn't realize that there would be people who would just out and out lie about it. And yet when I'm covering other topics that are meaningful to me in Indian country and to being Native, a survivor in this colonial enterprise, I constantly come up against finding other people that I'm interviewing or covering are either fake, fraud, they're not actually Native, or they work in academia, they work in the arts, and they're constantly being kind of having their careers threatened by fraud. Or, you know, it's a real straitjacket. It's absolutely astounding. It's not something I ever thought would be. I just had no idea that this was such a huge until I started covering it. And then when you come forward and reveal these people are frauds, there's tremendous pushback. They will never admit it. I mean, you saw it with Warren. They'll never admit. And it makes me feel like it's almost some kind of psychosis or something. But I do believe it is fundamental to the project of colonialism, the assumption of our identity, the right to take it, you know? And it's not an accident, you know? It's part of, it's a outcome of colonialism.
Well, you know, this...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I actually haven't fully read this book yet, and I picked it up out of my bookshelf, The Playing Indian by Philip DeLoria, which is just a really fascinating look at the entire history, and really, really well worth reading, including by myself, as I said. But in the introduction, he says, Benjamin Franklin knew that the breaking of the old world was a long process. In the depths of his own under consciousness, he hated England. He hated Europe. He hated the whole corpus of the European being. He wanted to be American, but you can't change your nature and mode of consciousness like changing your shoes. It is a gradual shedding. Years must go by and centuries must elapse before you have finished. It is a long and half-secret process. And then he talks about the Boston Tea Party where people dressed up as Native Americans. And just this, it's a very deep sort of cultural, psychological thing. This, I think I've long thought that, you know, there's this deep-seated guilt that's part of the, you know, the conquering, you know, dominating colonial process that, you know, it just goes way back even to, you know, Columbus's diaries where he, in one breath, he admired, you know, the beauty and the integrity and just the life force of the indigenous peoples, the happiness, the, you know, whatever of the people that he conquered. On the other hand, how easy it would be to enslave them. And then that, just that, that, I don't know, there's just a yearning for authenticity, that, you know, a yearning for, I guess, I think a jealousy of people who are on their own homelands and people who have left their homes so far behind and really can't go back anymore. There's just a whole bunch of things. And then like the assuming of that identity is a way to sort of both shed their European identity, which they've left behind, and to sort of become, anyway, there's just a whole mix of things that I don't think we get a chance to really look at in the kind of the helter-skelter.
Well, I mean, the actual fact of being a non-white person in this country is very difficult. I mean, and it's actually not something that, I mean, it's not, you know, I think, I actually think that it's, you know, just like blackface, it's an action of privilege. It's not sympathetic. It's actually a power grab. They want, because what whiteness tells white people about themselves that it are entirely positive things, that they're the best, that they're this, that they're that. There's a crisis. They can't handle any point of themselves being blemished in any way. And so then they look around for what else can they grab, what else can they take, and it's their right to take it, you know. And so then they take it. And a lot of these people, you know, I think that these individuals, particularly who actually assume a Native identity for decades, I mean, we're talking people who've done this for 40 years of their lives, day in and day out, lie, pretend, you know, falsify, even when all the evidence is shown to them, still refuse to admit the truth, you know. And that's just sort of a passing moment of gee, wouldn't it be great to be Indian? Aren't they lucky? Do you know what I mean? It's something else. That's something predatory. And especially when it means that when I interview, like if I'm interviewing folks, Native people in academia, they will say, you know, we're having this problem at my university. You know, they just hired a fake. You know, I try to talk to the other faculty. I try to talk to, you know, the dean, and they won't, you know, they say, well, we can't ask them because it would be, you know, illegal to make them prove they're Indian. And yet, you know, these people get, and actually looking at the hiring practices, I would really love to do a study of the hiring practices, because what I think is happening is that white people are hiring other white people to form our identity for them. Now, this is preferable to them than actually hiring actual Native people. And this happens on many levels in this colonial society. You know, well, I've talked a lot about masketry, you know, about the performance of Native identity, right? And it really, it is very much like blackface. You know, I've called it right. Actually, there was a study done in 2017. It was funded by the Kellogg Foundation, and they hired Dr. Stephanie Freiberg, who I cite a lot. She's a Tulalip tribal member and a researcher, and she's done a lot of research on masketry. And she and they also had other researchers as well. And what they did a bunch of focus groups, and what they found was that white people actually get incredibly it's incredibly a positive experience for them to see other white people dressed up in red face, like it reaffirms their in-group identity and their. And so that's sort of what we're fighting against when we're trying to stop masketry, right?
Speaking of masketry, I mean, your main focus has been the Washington football team, but of course, another football team just won the Super Bowl, and they've kind of passed somewhat under the radar.
Oh yeah, no, they have been on our radar this entire time. The Kansas City Chiefs, which the chief they're referring to was actually the mayor, a white mayor of Kansas City, who they called the chief, kind of transmogrified into a red face, and I guess that's more fun than dressing up like a early 20th century mayor. I mean, I really do think that this is a predatory action, and it's extension of privilege. And what they found in that research, too, they did focus groups and they also did surveys. And what they found was that But the masketry issue, only 30% of white Americans understood it or were sympathetic to it. And then they compared this, which was in 2017, so they compared it to Standing Rock and the treaty issues, the treaty rights issues there, and they found that over 80% of white Americans understood and were sympathetic to that issue. And so the conclusion they came to was that fighting the issue of red space and an assumption of Native identity is a much harder fight than even fighting for treaty rights at Standing Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Because white people are so resistant to it, and they get such a positive, it makes them feel really, really good about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, so, you know, so I would love to do a study where we look at, you know, the hiring practices and see who do they hire. Because I pretty much guarantee you that it's not going to be federally enrolled Native people. You know, that's not where if you do a cluster chart, a scatter chart, and see kind of based on different variables, you know, someone's identity lies, are they enrolled? How long have since their family have lived in a Native community? You know, do they speak their language? You know, what is their, you know, all these sorts of measures of sort of proximity to culture, to identity. And I pretty much assure you that it will be people who have very marginal claims to almost no claims, you know. and that speaks to a preference. I mean, we live in a white supremacist society. You know, there is a real preference for hiring white people and even white-presenting Native people, right, because they're less foreign, they're less strange, right, than hiring, like, a full-blooded Navajo person from the Rez. You know?
So let me. This idea of that you're saying that basically non-Native people are essentially replacing Indigenous people in certain positions that should be rightfully going to Native Americans because of, you know, preferential hiring practices and stuff like that, but aren't. So I just, this idea of replacement, which came out in such an ugly way at Charlottesville with those people with their little stupid tiki torches chanting, "You will not replace us," which led me to finally, in my slow way, get to this whole replacement, this ultra-racist replacement theory, which holds that you know, it's like the white genocide theory, that, you know, white people are being slowly or quickly taken over, killed off, whatever, by this this rising tide of people of color who are replacing them. Anyway, I mentioned at the outset that I, you know, as a settler colonial immigrant myself, I need to, you know, look at my own, you know, positionality where I come from. And I came across a description of settler colonialism. And I just heard that we have a caller, Dylan. Just hold on a second. And of course, this is a talk show. 503-231-8187 is the number. And I didn't write down where I got this from. I will link to it on my program page at kbo.fm. So let me, I just want to read this because I think it's important. I don't think we have solid conversations about, we talk about it, but we don't really necessarily get to the root of what settler colonialism is. We think maybe we understand colonialism, but settler colonialism is a distinct type of colonialism that functions through the replacement, there's that word, of indigenous populations with an invasive settler society that, over time, develops a distinctive identity and sovereignty. Settler colonial states include Canada, the United States, Australia, and South Africa. In some ways, I would say Israel, that's a slightly more, some much more problematic case. But, and settler colonial theory has been important to understanding conflicts in places like Israel, Kenya, and Argentina. And in tracing the colonial legacies of empires that engaged in the widespread foundation of settlement colonies. More recently, settler colonial analyses have been extended to the use of settler colonization in larger imperial projects and the impacts of settler colonial state power on global politics. As Lorenzo Veracini, a key scholar in settler colonial studies, argues, settler colonialism makes sense, especially if it is understood globally, and that we live in a settler colonial global present. settler colonialism can be distinguished from other forms of colonialism, including classical or metropole colonialism and neocolonialism, by a number of key features. First, settler colonialism has come to stay. Unlike colonial agents such as traders, soldiers, or governors, settler collectives intend to permanently occupy and assert sovereignty over indigenous lands. Second, settler colonial invasion is a structure, not an event. Settler colonialism persists in the ongoing elimination of indigenous populations and the assertion of state sovereignty and judicial control over their lands. Despite notions of post-coloniality, settler colonial societies do not stop being colonial when political allegiance to the founding metropole is severed. Third, settler colonialism seeks its own end, unlike other types of colonialism, in which the goal is to maintain colonial structures and imbalances in power between colonizer and colonized. Settler colonization trends towards the ending of colonial difference in the form of a supreme and unchallenged settler state and people. However, this is not a drive to decolonize, but rather an attempt to eliminate the challenges posed to settler sovereignty by indigenous peoples' claims to land, by eliminating indigenous peoples themselves and asserting false narratives and structures of settler belonging. And it goes on, but that's a big chunk right there.
I think that's a very good definition, but I don't like to use that term settler colonialism. I prefer to just use colonialism, because I think settler has too many positive connotations to many people, particularly because it's linked to the concept of progress, you know, and settling the land. And I don't think that colonists actually settle anything. You know, they don't settle for anything, and they don't settle the land. They basically occupy and exploit the land, and then they move on. And sometimes they don't even come; just their money and their power comes, and then moves on in the form of corporations to other parts of the world. So I think that.
Well, is that entirely true? I mean, because you know, there are populations of European Americans
who, with the pipelines and with all that's coming through our land, you know, and look at the Bakken. These are corporations. The people operating them never show up. They're not there in North Dakota, or they are in Houston, Texas. They are in other parts of the world. So I would say that it's. I think that the issue I have with the term settler colonialism is that to many people, the settling still has a very positive connotation. It seems to put the thing on individuals, when actually it's much more corporate than that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No, I understand.
It's not like the individual family on the prairie happily building, you know, the future progress of the land. And I prefer colonists, because it's far more jarring to the concept of self of people who have come here and told us that they have a better, that this is their land and they have a better way.
Okay.
And because it denies them any sort of right to the land. Mm-hmm. Because if you're a colonist, you don't have the right. So.
I get your points. I think there's possibly more to discuss about that, in terms of a differentiating between the.
But I agree with the definition, but I would say that the term, because I see it used a lot on Twitter by folks, but I don't think it has the impact they think it's having, because the terms having to do with settler is just too positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We got Dylan, who's been wanting to join the conversation, so let's go ahead and get Dylan on the. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Awesome. Hey. My name's Dylan. I'm so stoked you guys are talking about this. I had a question for your guest there. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Jacqueline Keeler.
Jacqueline. Yeah. So. My dad's side of the family is from Alaska. He's native Yupik, and my mom's white. And so she was a school teacher out in the bush, and obviously had me and my brother. And so this idea of like native identity is something that I've really been struggling with, because we didn't grow. I spent a couple years out there in Alaska, but my dad couldn't sober up or get his drinking together, and so my mom moved us out, and luckily she had a safe place to go back to live in California with her family, and so I didn't have a relationship with my dad or my native identity or culture till about like I was like 18 or no 21 about 08, and so I've been going back up to Alaska and fishing, putting up fish, set netting, and being with my family and my cousins up there, and that is where I really feel like I'm native. But down here in America, the lower 48, you know, sometimes I'm not going to deny that, like, I've benefited from or still have from white privilege, so it's a lot, I don't know, it feels sometimes weird for me to be like, yeah, I'm native, and people like look at me and I'm like, well, you know, if you saw my cousins were next to me. But one thing down here that I'm trying to do more of is when some friends, like, they'll, when I hear the word savage, like in like the mainstream culture now, even some of the, like, I work at an after school program, it's taken on a different meaning now, where it's like that means like kind of like hip or bad. Oh, I don't know if I can say the bad A word, but I've been trying to call people out on that, being like, hey, you know, that word, I don't really like that word, can you please use a different word? And sometimes people are like, oh no, it's okay, I'm native. And I'm like, because I myself don't necessarily look native. And so I was wondering what your advice or approach would be on how, when people like soft claim being native, how you could like challenge that, or what questions you could pose to be like, hey, you know, like, are you practicing your culture? Sorry if I was rambling, but you get what I'm getting at here?
No, yeah, I definitely do. Yeah, and I like that term, soft claim. You know, they're trying to kind of spitball a claim, you know, and I think it's interesting, because when I go, you know, when I meet other Native people, or I go back to either of my parents' reservations, the first thing people ask me is, who is your family, right? Where are you mm-hmm. from, you know? And yet when you ask people who are sort of falsifying their identity, you ask them these questions, and it's immediately very threatening to them. And then they make up things like, you're not supposed to ask things like that. And that's usually the first sign that someone is a fraud, or to some extent, that they are fraudulently claiming something. And the fact is that in our traditions, kinship, identity, we're the absolute, you know, we're fundamental to how our society is operated. You know, we didn't have authoritarian societies. You know, we didn't have feudalistic societies. What we had were like kinship societies. You know, in Navajo it's called Ke'e, and you know, in Dakota, you know, everything is about, you know, the Tioshkaya, you know, the family, you know, connections to one another, how we, the kinship relationships. And so, yeah, in polite traditional cultures, you never even spoke the person's name. You would immediately try to figure out how you were related to that person, and then call them by the kinship name, right? And so, it's hard, because when you ask someone who doesn't have an actual Native identity these questions, they get really angry, you know. Mm-hmm. If they were Native, they would be like, yeah, I'm from here. You know, this is the village I'm from. This is my family. You know, this is where, I mean, people are proud of where they're from, you know? And, yeah. It's not an issue, you know? And, mm-hmm. and in Navajo, actually, you introduce yourself by your clan. So you would immediately say, you know, where you're from, what your clans are, you know, for each of your grandparents. And so I think that and that's the thing, is sometimes I will we've had to have those conversations, and it seems like a lot to go through, especially when there's a lot of pushback, when it's a fairly they're not making these claims, and then you know, like, they're not trying to get a job for making these claims, they're not trying to make their career off of these claims, they're just trying to win the right to stay savage, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of ridiculous that we have to have these arguments at these very, just at every kind of everywhere we turn, you know. And I think sometimes that there have been websites and, you know, bulletin boards from way back that Native people have kept online kind of asking, is this person Native, and kind of accumulating enough information to decide whether someone is Native or not. But it's a lot of extra work, and it's really something I never expected. Do you know what I mean?
Because
I was working on an issue, like even mascots, and I'll find out, wait, oh, this person's not actually Native, who's like the major spokesperson, you know, or, you know, I mean, you're constantly, or this artist, or this person. It's just, I mean, it's absolutely crazy. You know,
that's really interesting. That I didn't know that was a thing, so to speak. The using sort of reclaiming is something good. The term savage.
It's sort of like I work at an elementary school, and like it's some of the kids. It's like almost like a compliment, kind of like beast mode. Like, oh, they're savage. Like they're bad. Like they're a bad A. Like they get their stuff done. And sometimes people will say that, and I'm like, whoa, hey, like, ooh, you know, like that makes me uncomfortable. Like, do you know, like, where that, what that word, before it was used in this context, what, you know, do you know who called my dad that and why? You know, like,
yeah,
it wasn't
yeah,
good. It wasn't a compliment.
Yeah, you can, I mean, one of the things that, particularly working with students, is you can look at the research of Dr. Stephanie Freiberg, and there she really did a lot of research on how these negative stereotypes impact Native youth, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And what her research found was that, so she did a lot of studies on masketry, and those have a lot of stereotypes like that in them. And suddenly there is this notion that we can reclaim negative things. But there's always a power dynamic in that. Who's doing the reclaiming, Jimmy?
Mm-hmm.
What she found was that students said that she kind of surveyed them before, early on, and asked them sort of what their dreams were, what they wanted to achieve, and then also, you know, what their position was on Native mascots, right? And then she exposed them to different mascots and stereotypes, and then tested them after that. And what she found was that it lowered their ability to dream about what they wanted to be, like their ability to set goals, their ability to want to achieve those goals in life. It actually lowered that. And then secondly, she found that Native students who said that they were okay with Native mascots, they had the sharpest, their goal setting fell the worst. Like they had the sharpest fall. And my theory in looking at that was always that, well, they're kind of trying to compensate. Like there's a level which you have to make that okay. Mm-hmm. And all the energy you expend doing that is energy you could have been using in other parts of your life. And so I think, so that's the way in which these things are, like, you know, where a Native student, I mean, most Native students in this country go to schools where they are not the majority. They are like the only Native student. That's the norm in this country, right? And so they have to, as a singular person, deal with all of this. And it's a very
situation.
If you go to a school where everyone is Native, then you're all as a group. You already have a context to understand Native identity that's has a much larger basis, right? But if you're the only Native student, all your classmates are participating in this and reinforcing on a certain level negative things. And another study actually done by the Buffalo State was basically, with, I think in 2015, they did a survey of stuff, and they basically found that Native mascots promote primarily negative stereotypes about Native people, and on top of that, they also are sort of an entry drug negative stereotypes about other ethnic and racial groups. And so certainly I think that language is definitely pliable, and can change in meaning, but there are aspects of it that. This is a much more difficult sort of thing, especially when it's not being done by the group themselves who are being, and they don't have a lot of say or control over how they are perceived by the majority.
Yeah, and that's one thing I think about when people make a soft claim and they're like, oh yeah, I'm a part Native, or I have some Native American in my family, and they want to like embody the like prestige and like pride of being Native and the positive identity of that. But then part of me is like do you know the struggles that like the Natives like go through, like up in Alaska, living up in the bush in the village, the alcoholism, the abuse, the suicide. You know, it's like sometimes I try to like bring that into the conversation, because it's like, you know, they want to, the power grab you were saying, it's like they just want to take the good of it and use that to empower them, but they ignore like the reality of being living by colonizers and being screwed over by them. I was wondering if what your thoughts were on that.
You know, one of the things I do a lot of research on is history, and you know, like in my own family, you know, my father is a mixed blood. He's 5/8 Yank and Sioux and 3/8 European, but and his father was 3/4 Indian and 1/4 white German American, but you know, my grandfather was beaten to death by the white police.
Yeah.
In the town of Yankton, just outside of our reservation. And
damn.
And the trauma of that, I mean, you know, my father and his siblings and my grandmother never told me that that's the way he died. It was that traumatic for them. We found out because my cousin was doing research on Ancestry.com and found a newspaper article about my grandmother demanding a second autopsy of my grandfather. And that's the only way we found out the truth. You know, we were told he drowned, right? Because his body was not, they couldn't identify his body of the being.
Wow.
And my dad was sent to, as a, like a 14-year-old, he was sent to identify his body, his father's body. And it's, just so he said my father could pass for white, you know, I mean, he looked kind of like, I don't know, Anthony Bourdain or something like that, you know what I mean? But he never trusted white people ever. Do you know what I mean? Their families may be some small percentage white from 200 years, a small percentage of Native from 200 years ago. They have lived as white people and enjoyed the privilege.
Yeah. My dad always would, he was half joking, but he was kind of serious. He's like, when they would get picked for jury duty, he would be like, if they're Native, innocent. If they're white, guilty. But it kind of underlined the sentiment you were saying, too, about trust and feelings towards, being colonized.
Listen, we're kind of only got about 20 minutes left. Dylan, I should let you go. I really appreciate your calling
in.
It was great talking with
you. Thank you. Yeah. I just want to give a shout out to Naya and Nara, and I like to donate and give to them. And you guys are awesome. Love you. You're all superheroes. Peace.
All right. Great. Thanks. And this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. You've been coming in and out there, Jackie. I don't know what's going on. We lost you for a second. But
yeah. Sorry.
We definitely lost Jackie. So while I ask Liam to get her back, or maybe she'll call back, I want to let you know that coming up next on Inside Washington County at 9:00 with Rob Solomon, this week we hear part two on affordable housing and homelessness, where Rob's conversation with Cole Merkel, Cadence Petros, and Nathan Teske focuses on homelessness. At 9:30, it's Wings, where we hear Winnie Mandela addressed the first Million Woman March held in Philadelphia. After that, at 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, The Dirt Bag. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. If you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today, which of course you can find on KBO.FM, where you can find this and almost all other programs except the syndicated, nationally syndicated ones on that website. You can listen to them again, or if you missed part of it. And you can find various links to books, articles mentioned, which I will provide. So Do we have Jackie back? We don't, but we do have Bobby online. We don't have Jackie, but I will attempt to engage with you. Go ahead, Bobby.
My name's Robbie.
Okay.
I just wanted to actually, it was a really interesting listening to this because it's what Dylan brought up is the exact same kind of identity. I don't know what to call myself, really. I always grew up when I was, my dad's extremely Mexican. My mom was, I grew up thinking I was Mexican and German. I had my DNA tested, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, and found out that I'm about 32% Native American. And so it's funny because when I lived in Arizona, people had always assumed that I was, you know, of Latino descent. And then when I came to Oregon here in Portland, it's like, it's funny, but, you know, I became white. And I've never really claimed, you know, being a Native American. I can understand that, you know, it's funny, but when the topic gets brought up and I do mention, I have that 32% DNA, whatever it is. It's really funny because the first question that comes up is like, oh, well, you know, what tribe do you belong to? And I'm like, I don't know. My Mexican family lived in Michigan, you know, and then I actually wrote this joke. I do some stand-up comedy occasionally, but I like to say that I'm a Mexican-Canadian, which is just a confusing way of saying you're a Native American.
You know, that's interesting. But, we'll go ahead, finish your thought.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Well, I was just, I spent a little time in Arizona working on the Mount Graham Sacred Apache Land telescope issue.
I have a very deep respect for Mount Graham. I know different Native American communities, and I've practiced with their medicine.
Oh, right on. Well, I was just gonna say when I touched base there relatively briefly, I actually met one young woman who was beginning to identify as Apache because she learned that she actually. Her origins, I don't know how much, but were at least partly Apache, but she had grown up the same way, thinking that they were, you know, a Mexican immigrant family, Latino. And that seemed to be, from what I understand, a not uncommon thing because it was the same thing here, where now, you know, people, have this certain, there's a certain cachet to some people in being Native American, whereas before people were... pretty desperate or very it was important to try to hide that because there's serious negative consequences.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Jackie. Can I speak to that really fast?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I think that being able to I think the really important thing is finding out finding out who your people are. Do you know what I mean? And doing the connecting with them. And I think because what we've had a lot of problems with, and I've been covering this issue in with the Chumash in California, is that we have these people who, and also an author who claimed to be Pueblo, that basically that their ancestors, when we did the actual family trees, and this isn't DNA, of course, related, but their actual family trees, that they were actually Spanish colonists with no Native identity, you know, not from the area, at least. And, some of their Native blood is from like 1590 or something like that, you know, and it becomes an issue of where, and so you have, we were, the Los Angeles Times did the story about Mati Waya, who was this guy who's claiming to be a Chumash traditional elder and stuff like that. And he's got all of Malibu all excited about him and donating money to him. And when they did his family tree, he's not Chumash at all, you know. His family and the local Chumash people were trying to tell them that, saying, "Hey, no, this is a Spanish family. They're Spanish colonists."
Go ahead, Robbie.
And so, well, I mean, obviously, this isn't DNA, but this is an issue of where people actually need to sit down and do the work and find out who their people are, rather than making just kind of nebulous claims and then, you know, speaking for us. You know.
Well, go ahead, Robbie.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention the that's kind of an issue. My mom was the one who did the whole ancestry DNA thing and was trying to figure this out. But apparently, during the Mexican Revolution is when my family from that side went into Texas and into Michigan. So that's as far as I can trace it back. But ultimately, there was and actually I find it amazing that you were at Mount Graham. That is a very sacred mountain. One of my favorite stories about Geronimo is on that mountain. It's a very sacred mountain. It's a very interesting mountain indeed. But I think I just wanted to say, it's like, I think one thing that I'm trying to figure out is like, when, like, at, would you consider me of Native American descent if it was, you know, that, you know, I'm just wondering if that is.
Yeah, I think part of it is that, you know, Native American identity is one of the issues is the issue of race. I mean, is you know, right now we have the Supreme Court it's in the courts right now, this issue about ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, and right. For Indigenous nations within the United States, I've traveled through Mexico and visited Indigenous communities there, and they have a political relationship with the Mexican government. Many of them do, you know, and they are distinct from the local Mestizo communities around them, right? Mm-hmm. And the Mestizo culture in Mexico, I think, also should have value in and of itself. Even if it doesn't no longer has an extant Indigenous connection to a political, so being Indigenous in the United States is not just about race. It's a political identity. We're nations. We're nations within the United States. We have nation to nation agreements with the United States. We have treaties. Treaties are only entered into by nations. And so in that way, it's not about race, because politically, you know, it's about our political standing as citizens of nations. Right. And so when we're dealing with the U.S. government, we have political business with them that goes back hundreds of years with the United States government. Right. You know, First Nations folks in Canada have a political relationship with the British Crown. Right. With the Crown. That's where they're put. And, you know, extant Mexican Indigenous communities have a political relationship with their colonizer. Right. With, you know, and so it's this is the aspect that gets lost. When anybody can suddenly speak for us, because you know you may have 30% Indigenous ancestry, right? But if you're not tied to a political nation, you don't have any stake in the outcome of our political negotiations with the United States, and that's what's at stake.
Well, I guess I don't. You know? I guess you could say I don't have anything. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was saying, I guess, you know, I don't have anything at stake outside of, you know, when I was, I don't know, I've had a police brutality. I've experienced racism firsthand in the state of Arizona. But, you know, ultimately, though, when you said that I need to find my people, I have participated in Native American churches. Sure. I've joined different things. And although, so it's, it's all my people. I fight for all the people.
Yeah. Yeah, the Native American Church thing is based in our political relationship with the United States as well.
It grants permission to use the medicines and the rituals,
only if you're enrolled in a federally recognized tribe, though. You know, you actually and so these are agreements that we made as citizens of nations with another nation. These are what these laws are based on. So you can be of any perceived racial background and still be a citizen of a Native nation.
Well,
you know,
I understand that, I'm saying. That's how I've had to go and find my people, as you.
Yeah, no, no, that's great. I think it's great to participate. It's great to be, you know, to stand up for what's right. And but you know, when we're talking about the issues that we're facing, it's based in our political, national interests as citizens of Native nations. Of this land.
So basically, just to clarify or add something, is that so essentially what you're saying is that there's these sort of somewhat clear, although there's a lot of unrecognized peoples. Like I was reading this article about the Lumbees in North Carolina, which have a incredibly complex, difficult. So it's not, you know, the process of federal recognition seems. It seems clear cut.
Well, I'm not. You know, let me clarify something here. You know what historical research provides us with is actually because we have a lot of fakes even at the tribal level. You know, I mean there are, you know, the Cherokee Nation went and tried to identify how many fake Cherokee tribes were in the country, and they stopped at 400. There are like 20 here in Oregon Cherokee tribe. You know, it's like there are a lot of fake tribes, people who are, and I had to, I did an article about that for the Daily Beast about there's a lot of fake Lenape tribes in Pennsylvania. You know, there's all the fake, when we are disappeared, people fill the vacuum to replace us.
Right, but that
even
doesn't,
politically.
Go ahead.
I'm saying that even, so we have, so there has to be some sort of level at which we can ascertain if their claims are accurate or not, or whether this is a group of white people who have emerged to create their own tribe in our absence.
You know, and actually, I get that. And if I could just ask one last question.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that was perfect. I was hearing that, and then if I could just get just the one last question. Like for me, I don't ever flaunt, you know, claiming I'm Native American. However, I'm just wondering what you consider about Elizabeth Warren having claimed that.
Yeah, I've actually written about that, and part of it was the issue of race. Is that her claim, her DNA claim, basically? What's going on is the Goldwater Institute and a lot of right-wing institutes, right-wing Republicans are trying to terminate tribes politically. They're trying to get rid of us as actual nations. And so one of the ways they're doing this is to say that we are illegal under the Constitution because we are race-based, right? Because we base our identity on race. And this is why I'm saying that the racial aspect is not the main aspect. The aspect is political citizenship, right? To be citizens of the nation.
So Elizabeth Warren, having claimed that, I'm just curious about how
she didn't read
your article.
She basically bolstered the argument that Republicans are using to eliminate us politically from the face of the earth. Right.
Are you aware that she used that to get a college scholarship?
Well, I don't know if she got a college scholarship. I do know that
she
there
did.
Was
that's
question.
Why that's why she initially claimed it.
Oh yeah, I know that she did put it on her bar. She wrote it onto her car for her Texas bar card and stuff. And then there is, you know, I mean, and Harvard did cite her.
Well, she had to continue the lie. She had to continue the lie after she got the scholarship, which is why she had to double down on it all.
Let's let Jacqueline finish. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So the issue with her using the DNA and the issue why the Cherokee Nation was so opposed to that, right? And the Cherokee Nation does not use blood quantum for citizenship. All you have to do is prove that you have an ancestor on the rolls, on the tribal rolls.
Right.
And so, it weaponized DNA claims weaponize the it basically bolsters the arguments of our enemies, right? Who want us to go away.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's the part of how they're trying to get rid of it, because now you have to maintain on those tribes that you do have to maintain a certain percentage. Now you have to marry and tribe and that,
yeah,
you know, because your families don't want you to not.
Is not our tradition. It's very similar in many ways to saying that to have American citizenship, you would have to have a certain percentage of Revolutionary War blood. You know, like,
good point. Yeah,
I mean, imagine how
point.
Insane that would be, because basically all of that blood quantum stuff is just, it's a screenshot of who were members of our nation at that moment in time, right? And it's not, and yeah, I think I support, my goal is I support sovereignty of tribes, because it's the only because we were nations here before colonialism came. And the only just thing to do is to recognize our sovereignty, and to honor treaties, to return land, and you know, we're talking about treaties, we're talking about issues, and the only people who have standing to do that are the citizens of those nations. I mean, I could go to Canada and speak out for First Nations people, but you know, I have no standing as far as their legal situation as nations. Do you know what I mean? I've traveled through Mexico and met many indigenous communities, but I couldn't legally speak on their behalf because I have nothing in that game. I mean, I have nothing, no skin in that game at all. Do you know what I mean? Because I'm not a citizen of any of their nations.
Okay, Robin, we got to let you go. We only got a minute left. Thank you.
Okay. I mean, I often say it's like a Belgian trying to invoke French rights and French treaties. I mean, they're all European, but politically they're not French. So.
Well, this is an extremely interesting and complicated I hope it's helped.
Yeah, I'm wanting to do more writing. I've done a lot of writing on the issue, but I think it needs to maybe, I could just do a whole essay on it, just sort of laying out everything that I've encountered over the years, the different issues and the spectrum of it. And some of the, I actually do have some ideas of how to resolve some of it.
Well, you know,
that would take the conversation beyond colonial borders.
Well, I had on as a guest Siadom Edmo a couple months ago, and she actually, along with Jesse Young and Alan Parker, wrote a book called American Indian Identity, Citizenship, yes. Membership, and Blood, which I will link to as well on my program page, kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. Of course, there's also the question of, is the United States government itself legitimate?
Sadly, they're as legitimate as their military allows them to be. Isn't that the case?
Indeed. But the questions you raise are of extreme importance because Donald Trump himself has raised, once again, various ways, the specter of moving forward with some of the things you're talking about, right? And there's also the whole issue of disenrollment within tribes themselves. It's incredibly complicated. But we are playing out of time, Jacqueline.
Okay, sure.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll be with you again next month.
Okay. All right, talk to you.
All right, bye-bye. And this is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned next inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Thanks for listening.